Now, you'll probably, I suspect, have one of this man's books in your home. He's the author of The Ontological Status of the Photographic Image in Aesthetic and Analytic Philosophy. But you probably don't have that one. In any way, the recipes are rubbish. He's probably better known for Plenty and Plenty More. Jerusalem, Noppy, Sweet. The eponymous Ottolenghi, he's one of those rare combinations of person and phenomenon. And he's given a generation what he rather evocatively calls drama in the mouth. He's now touring the country to promote his latest book, Simple. Yotam Ottolenghi, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
What's the last thing you cooked?
The last thing I cooked? Well, that is a very good question because I haven't cooked for at least 5 days because I've been in Australia.
Does this make you a bit twitchy?
Yes, it does, because I cook way less than I used to. I spend a lot of time developing recipes and ideas. But I cook at home. I think probably the last thing I cook was a meal for my... I've got two young children, and they love one dish, which is called majadra. It's rice with lentils and fried onion, and it's every Middle Eastern boy's idea of heaven. It's, and I know it sounds really healthy, but it's full of fried onion, and we all know that fried onion is sweet, and kids love something sweet. So I serve that to them with a good helping of yogurt, and they absolutely love it.
I ask about that, last time you cook. Is this one of those things about being sort of swept up in success that you create distance from the thing that brought you there?
Yeah.
That thing at the core of what you do.
Well, this is a correct observation. I mean, I started off being one of those people who just loved eat. I mean, every chef starts off by being very greedy, just wanting to eat all the time. And I didn't even cook that much then. And then I kind of, the next stage in my career was actually cooking in restaurants and delis, or all these places that I worked at. And now I find myself cooking much less. I've got a team of recipe developers, maybe more masterminding recipes than cooking. And most of the cooking that I actually do is for my family at home, from my husband, my kids. And it's it's a whole different kind of development in my career. But I mean, it's all fun.
Yes.
It's all good. But I cook much less than I ever did.
The great thing is that your passion becomes your work, and the downside of that is that your work is your passion.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, anyone who recommends to anyone to follow their dreams and follow their passions and turn them into their profession, I have to say, like you suggested, the downside is that you have to become focused, which means you take a little bit of the magic out of it. I still love to eat.
Are you still greedy?
I'm still greedy, yeah. I'm still greedy. And I've been on
this... And look at you. You're a wisp of a man. You're fading away.
Well, I've been away for a few days and nobody's been feeding me. In actual fact, when I've been here for about... in Australia for about 5 days, and I still haven't eaten in a restaurant because I've been doing all sorts of public activities. So I'm looking forward to having a proper meal in a restaurant.
Are you fairly forgiving of that sort of road food, of the things that you'll be getting in hotels and buffet breakfasts?
Yeah, I know. Like I said to you, the motivation is greed. So so I can kind of more or less eat anything and everything.
You spoke there about that sort of team of recipe testers and so forth. Let's take your new book, Simple. For something to appear there, for a recipe to appear there, what's the process behind that? How does it get onto the page?
So, I mean, the recipes often start from a conversation where myself and probably one or two other people would sit down and decide, what do we want to cook? And the motivation could be a book, it could be a meal that we had a couple of weeks ago, could be a magazine article. But it's what we want to cook. And a bunch of ideas come up and we talk and kind of hone them before we even start cooking. And then someone would start cooking that particular recipe. And this is a very rigorous process. You know, we would try it first and then second. And then I don't think there's any recipe that is finalized before three or four test runs.
What's this room? How many benches in it? How many people? Is it like a laboratory of food?
Well, it's not very sexy because it's under it's under a railway arch in North London. And I made it particularly unglamorous because I didn't want to have anything.
No distractions.
That is one thing. But I also didn't want any kind of high-tech equipment because it's all about home cooking. I mean, it needs to feel like anyone's kitchen and not the top kitchen, but almost like the bottom range because I don't know what people will cook with and I want the recipes to work for them. So there's no thermomixers and sous vide machines. It's a normal home mixer. It's a normal hob. It's a normal oven. And it looks very mundane.
So
and simple.
A normal domestic hob. So that you're not even getting restaurant sort of heat.
Not know? At all. No, it's counterintuitive. And we also shop in like normal supermarkets. I wouldn't get the top of the range ingredient from the local Italian deli because I don't know that everyone will get that. So we shop in local supermarkets. And
except that you have changed the nature of the local supermarket.
Well, that helps sometimes. If they have what I want, if I can get my pomegranate molasses at the local supermarket, that's an achievement. But I'm dead serious that I just want to make sure when I test a recipe, I want to make sure that I have an idea of what it will really taste like when people have cooked it at home.
Do you find that in a little way limiting? I mean, would you like to sort of push out into Blumenthal territory?
Not at all. No, I'm happy to leave that to him. Very happy.
No mousses.
Yeah, no, my instincts are very basic. They are from the world of domestic cookery. Even if you look at the, you know, famous Ottolenghi counter with all the food, all the salad, vegetable displays, and it actually is, the techniques are really simple. And I've always been drawn to simple techniques. I mean, in the world of food, there is the trailblazer technology people, you know, that really push the boundaries in those respects. And there's those people that love a certain familiarity and use, you know, things that are familiar and well known. And I've always been drawn more to the domestic scene than to the cutting edge scene.
Do those trailblazers really help? Does that trickle down into domestic food?
It does eventually. I mean, you look at the machines that we use. They weren't, not everybody had a hob 200 years ago. I mean, technology in food is incredible. I mean, last year I did this project with the Metropolitan Museum in New York, which we were looking at the food of in Versailles in the 19th and 18th centuries. Sorry, 18th and 17th centuries. And all the technology of pastry, meringues and layering butter, you know, to create puffs and all that, it's all been invented 300, 400 years ago. And I'm sure people would have said at the time, I mean, this is insane. How can you cook a choux paste, you know, something like a choux pastry and then stick it in the oven and then it puffs up? This is like mad technology. And now it's commonplace if you're a pastry chef or even at people at home.
You have a fascination with, I mean, I think you're a polymath. You're a, you know, you're a student of the species. You have a philosophic interest.
I like the context. I like to know about the context of, in this case, food, and I love the stories and I love the history of a dish or of a discipline. And I do all sorts of projects because for me, you know, especially in this day and age, recipes are so abundant and they're everywhere and on every medium and in every book and on every screen. I love the idea that I can learn a little bit more and scrape the surface, whether it's political, whether it's philosophical, whether it's historical, whether it's personal. You know, when I did a series, well, my first TV program was for BBC 4 in the UK, and it was called Jerusalem on a Plate, and it was a documentary about Jerusalem through the angle of food. And I remember traveling around and speaking to people, all sorts of people about food, and it was incredibly interesting to see how you start a conversation talking about bulgur wheat or stock or how to poach a chicken or a piece of lamb, and immediately it turns into family and history and daily hardships or whatever it is you're going to move on to talk about. And I love these connections. I love seeing how food is a gateway to a bigger conversation.
And that, with your food, is so utterly true. I mean, you mentioned there Jerusalem on the plate. This takes us to your childhood in that city and the food of that place.
Yeah.
And I guess in that environment too that you mentioned of we're surrounded by so much now in food and cooking, is the stuff that cuts through, the stuff that has that earthiness, that has that sort of core of deep personal experience.
I think those are the things that really stand out. I mean, I am exposed all the time to food and to recipes. And I find that more and more now, in particular, because of that deluge of information, the interesting things do come to the surface, and you get really great personal stories that come with recipes. I mean, one of the things that I've noticed recently, that out of the certain tragedies, you know, things that have been happening in Syria, for instance, cuisines have come up to the surface. You know, like there is a whole load of recipes and dishes being cooked by refugees from Syria and other parts of the world, in the place where they've been displaced to or moved to. There's kind of a movement called Cook for Syria that started in London and is kind of spreading worldwide, and that chefs are kind of giving their resources to help in the Syrian crisis. And all of a sudden people talking about Syrian food and refugees cook it in public spaces. This is incredible.
Yotam Ottolenghi with us on Blueprint. Is there a certain sort of first world decadence in our picking over the cuisines of struggling peoples?
I guess there is. I mean, if you check people's motivations, then you might find that there is that kind of maybe not totally pure drive in terms of wanting to kind of find the next big thing, and that would come through. They would look for any means to achieve that. But I do think that food functions in a very interesting way because it's a great unifier. So when I personally look at a question, a political, a tragedy, something that has happened through the prism of food, I think I understand it a little bit better because I don't need to speak the actual language. I speak the language of food. And I think that really helps. It does create some kind of sense of, okay, so we can all gather together and galvanize to look at the problem. And food is a really good prism to look through.
And yet, let's go to Jerusalem. I mean, there is a place that both sides of an argument share a lot in terms of food, and yet share so little in terms of understanding.
Yeah, I mean, I've been asked this question many times, and I always answer, you know, food is a necessary condition to you know, being able to share, to sit together and have a meal is a necessary, would be necessary to any kind of progress, but it's not enough. I mean, there needs to be a lot of goodwill on all sides to make progress.
I guess what it points to is perhaps some of the absurdities of that other disconnection. Here we are at this basic level, so connected, and yet.
Yeah, I mean, that always just bugs me so much, because when you talk about Jerusalem, and it's true about other parts of the world, you know, look at America and Mexico at the moment, you know, there's so much negativity around and so much hate and racism. But in actual fact, people would sit around the table and eat exactly the same food and love the same kind of things. And in Jerusalem, you see that. I mean, everybody loves the same dishes. You know, the Orthodox Jew from one side of town will have the same eggplant salad that the Palestinian family would have on the other side of that divide. And they wouldn't have they would have nothing else in common. They wouldn't even try to find a common ground.
Your Ottolenghi table as a greedy boy would have been a complex one. You have an Italian father, a German mother. What did that do food-wise?
So, you know, I grew up in this kind of incredible mumble jumble of food. You know, I really had everything at home, and things that were really unrelated. I remember my
schnitzel and hummus.
Schnitzel and hummus. And my mom had this book called The International Cookbook. It was very big in the 60s and 70s. And she would make like Malaysian curries and tiramisus and things and sabayons and things that were kind of from very different, diverse cultures. And I think I benefit from this very much because, first of all, I was exposed to great food. And also, thanks to the fact that I don't feel that I'm bound to one tradition. You know, I feel that I could actually, you know, go in between food traditions and benefit and create something which makes sense as a whole, but without belonging to one tradition.
This equipped you utterly for sort of gastronomic modernity. This is, I mean, that's the key, is it not, of modern food?
Yeah, absolutely. And my story is not so unusual. I mean, in this day and age, you get a lot of people who are children of many cultures, both within their families, but also where they grew up, if they're immigrants or if they just, you know, traveled throughout their lives. And I think it makes the world a much more interesting place. And I love this kind of language that has evolved around food. Like the other day I was looking at I was following someone on Instagram and they were doing this kind of, there was this moment, or there is this moment of like obsession with Brussels sprouts. And, you know, Brussels sprouts were so loathed not too long ago by so many people. And all of a sudden, every trendy place serves a plate of roasted Brussels sprout with this or that hoisin or Asian sauce or whatever. And you'd see that at the same time happening in somewhere like Moscow and it's and in Brooklyn. You know, it's just that it's a great connector and
great instantaneity about it.
Yeah, people love to kind of rubbish social media, but it is a connector.
You're the man responsible for the resurgence of cauliflower, of course. Brussels sprouts,
Brussels sprouts, cauliflower, any brassica you give it to me, I'll have it.
Your relationship with the vegetable world is an interesting one because you're an omnivore. You love your meat. Were you pushed by the circumstance of The Guardian towards a greater affection for vegetables?
The original impetus was actually, it was a Guardian column. I think I remember that
they wanted a vegetarian.
Yeah,
writer,
The Guardian wanted me to write a vegetarian column, and I remember I spoke to my agent. I mean, she wasn't really quite an agent at that stage because I didn't need one, but she was a customer in our deli, and she said to me, "Well, take it. You know, beggars can't be choosers. You know, you're offered a column, just take it." And I was really kind of struggling at the beginning with the idea of being able to produce on a regular basis, you know, interesting vegetarian dishes. But I soon realized that actually it's much easier when you have such a clear remit to come up with a very creative set of dishes.
Did that make you reframe your thinking about what you put on the table? I mean, that sort of reorients
completely
food.
I think in many fields, but I know food firsthand. Being able to know exactly what you're aiming for and what are the limitations are, it clears your mind. And since then, I think I've published many hundreds of vegetarian recipes, and I never worry about where the inspiration is going to come from. It just comes.
We're sort of losing the divisions a bit. I'd say Gordon Ramsay has apparently gone vegan.
Oh, I didn't know that. But
that YouTube video of Gordon Ramsay making a celeriac Wellington is a thing to behold.
Well, everybody seems to have gone vegan. And I have to say that I think whatever comes out of this vegan trend, I think it's going to be necessarily a good thing, because I don't think so many people are going to stay vegan. They might, I'm not sure. But I think people learn through these fashions. They learn something stays, something sticks. It's a vocabulary, it's an understanding. And vegan, you know, half the Indian subcontinent would have been vegan, or maybe still is vegan at some stage. And it's a very valid way of eating, whether it's practical or preferable or doable for many people. But I've always been very pragmatic about my preferences. And I thought, get the meat eaters to eat more vegetables by not banning meat. You know, that was always been like, you know, there's something very pragmatic about this approach. And I think get everybody to eat a lot of vegan food and see how delicious it is so they can have it more.
How would you phrase your broad approach? I mean, what's your sort of cooking mission statement? What does it all sort of fall under?
I don't like to be, for me, it's about flavor, really. It's never been about anything else. There's all sorts of other things I worry about sometimes, about health and sustainability and other aspects of cooking. But the flavors were always first and will always come first, because I think if you don't start from that starting point, then you're going to lose people along the way. Because all the other aspects, food is really a sensual thing, and we're all drawn to it because we do it every day and we want to get joy out of it. And sometimes I'm worried that other parts of the conversations take prime position and people forget that we have to enjoy what we eat. So joy has always been my prime consideration.
Smiling food is one of your...
Smiling food. Yes. And afterwards, I think it's very important to think where the food comes from, what we do, what it means for future generations. But it's really, for me, it's always been all about those incredible flavors that you can get out of your cauliflower.
which is a diverse field. I mean, this is the interesting thing. For, you know, Western cooking has sort of framed itself around meat for so long. And that is sort of, it's a limiting factor. Once you free yourself of that as a thought, it doesn't exclude meat, but it includes it as part of just a complete palate.
Yeah, I think where things went wrong is when meat has become something that you eat solely or almost solely in a meal. I mean, when I wrote the book Jerusalem with Sami Tamimi, we were constantly fascinated by how much meat was used in Jerusalem, which was and still is not the most affluent city, as a flavor rather than as a substance to eat. You know, so you would take, I'll give you an example of a Palestinian way of cooking chicken or lamb. You take a small piece of lamb or chicken with a lot of bones, and you make it into a soup. You know, you put water in and your spices, allspice, maybe some bay leaves, things that give cinnamon, things that give it a character. And then you get a lot of stock and some meat, and you cook your bulgur wheat or your rice with that stock. So, and you put it over bread. So you have a layer of beautiful pita bread, a grain that's cooked in the stock, and then just some of that shredded meat. And then a nut on top and yogurt or tahini. So the meat aspect in it is very small, but it creates so much flavor. And that would be a whole meal that would last for a few days based on a small cut of meat.
And that's common to so many cuisines of not rich cultures. I'm thinking of Southeast Asia, where there's likewise a sort of a stock culture in cooking.
And the rest would be the noodles or the vegetables or whatever it is you're cooking with. And I think that is so much more sensible, because you're completely throwing the baby with the bathwater if you're going to be dropping meat altogether. You won't have those flavors, which are great flavors. And you won't win people over to eating more vegetables because they won't taste as good. So, I mean, a drop of fish sauce in an otherwise completely vegetarian, vegan dish transforms it. And it doesn't take a lot of fish to make fish sauce. So I just think that these are the kind of things, these are the kind of exercises that we should be thinking about in this day and age to get people to eat more vegetables.
The Ottolenghi enterprise, it might be eponymous, but it's a very collective, very collaborative thing. You work in teams.
Yeah, I've always done. People don't want to know about that. They always want to look and just see me, which is fine. I can deal with that. But it's always been collaborative. And I've started off by collaborating a lot with Sami Tamimi, who's my co-author of Jerusalem and the Ottolenghi Cookbook. And we grew up in Jerusalem together, and we go back a long way, and we still collaborate. But then I've collaborated with other people. The Test Kitchen, which we talked about, is really a place where a lot of people from different cultures get together. I've worked with Helen Goh, who's an Australian, lives in London, on the book Sweet, which was published last year. Another Aussie is Scully, Ramal Scully, who's worked at Nopi and now has his own restaurant in London. So I always collaborate, and I always find that this is the way forward, you know, to have these collaborations.
Bring your minds. Yeah.
I don't have enough ideas myself, you see. I always need someone else to inspire me.
I wonder if the thing that you bring is your mouth, your palate.
It's possibly the palate. I think I'm pretty good at kind of letting people shine and do their thing without taking over too much. People do like that collaborative way of working. And not too many chefs do that, but I know some that do that. And it really pays off, because you end up having such a much broader set of options when you work in a group rather than if you work individually.
That thing of palate, though, I think is interesting. I mean, you spoke before about sort of recreating that domestic cooking environment. On one of those, you taste food yourself. You were tasting that with expertise. I mean, we can't know the sensory experience of another person. You don't know how your food tastes to someone else.
Yeah, that is very true. And a palate is a very individual tool. You know, everyone has a different palate. And you're probably right in the sense that I have, over the years, discovered or defined what my palate was. I don't think I was kind of born with it. I mean, I guess to a degree, yes. But over the years, I have understood what... It's funny saying that, even uttering that, like what Ottolenghi stands for. I mean, that's my surname, but it stands for a certain complexity, a certain level of interest, a certain element of surprise in a dish. And I know, when I eat something, I know whether it will fit that palate. And other people know that now too, because they've cooked and eaten the food over the years. But I think I've got a much clearer idea of what an Ottolenghi dish stands for than I used to have.
This is possibly the interesting thing, because I think we cook from people's books, according to those combinations of flavors. Yours are, say, different to Anna Jones.
Yes.
The way that people put things together is quite distinct.
Yeah, and it's, I think it's really fascinating. Like, I remember a few years ago, we tried testing a recipe in the test kitchen for a pea soup. And it was a really beautiful pea soup. It was vibrant green and very sweet and beautiful. So all the freshness of the pea was captured in that soup. And everybody tested it and someone said, but it's not very Ottolenghi. And it could have been a really good Nigel Slater, who was a British cookery writer, because there was that kind of simplicity. It felt quite British. And then we quickly made this toast. So we took some bread and we used goat cheese and black and red peppercorns, and we rolled it into a roulade and fried it. So we turned it into kind of a goat's cheese crouton that looked nice because it was shaped in a roulade, and put that on top. And all of a sudden, it was an Ottolenghi dish.
a touch of sharp dairy.
But I think that's what people expect now. I mean, again, there's so many voices and so many great cooks around. So what you have to offer is quite important that people would know that, understand that, because that's the expectation that they have.
There are so many voices and so many people, I think, you know, cook for a general taste in the mouth. Yeah. Others go far more specific and are far more identifiable. It's an interesting thing. What's a notable failure from the Ottolenghi test kitchen?
A failure.
Something that got binned in disgust.
We have a lot of failures, I have to say. We're all, not just myself, but all of us, we're very persistent. Mm-hmm. At the moment, I've just posted something. We've been trying to achieve a really good lentil and barley-based ragu to use for mashed potatoes or semolina or polenta, whatever it is you want to put your ragu, vegetarian ragu, over. And one of my collaborators, another test kitchen person, it's called Ista Belfrage, she's been testing that ragu so many times. I think this was test number 12 or 13, I can't
she
remember.
She would never look at that thing again.
And you really lose your sense of, like, after you've tested something 10 times, you look at it and you think, I can't really do it any longer. And so you need to bring a fresh mouth, a fresh palate to the conversation. Someone else, like someone that works maybe in administration, get them to try and say, what do you think? Because sometimes you just don't know anymore. And that's the price you pay for being, you know, surrounded by food all the time.
Jotam Ottolenghi, you have been found guilty of first-degree murder. You'll be taken from here to a place of execution. However, you have one last meal. What's that going to be?
Well, the meal will start with a dish that I have never published up until Simple, because I never thought I got it quite right, and that's called gnocchi alla romana. My grandmother used to make it. It's one of the simplest and easiest things to get right, but also one of the simplest and easiest things to get wrong. And essentially, it's a pot of semolina that's cooked a bit like polenta, you know, with milk, a bit of nutmeg, a bit of cheese and butter, and then set and then put under the grill with some more cheese to melt on top, Parmesan or Pecorino. And I've tried it many times in the past, but I couldn't quite get to the level of my grandmother. And then recently, a friend of mine who's a Sicilian Italian, he made it for me, and I thought, okay, that gets very close to her level. So he told me the exact proportions, and so that's in Simple. That would be my starter.
See, an important meal, that kind of last meal idea, is not only a thing of taste, but it's a thing of memory, of people, of place. These are all the things that food combines.
Absolutely. And also the troubles that you've gone through to achieve it, that's also there.
You could be your grandmother, Jotam. It's possible.
Some of these flavors that you have when you grow up, they're just completely unachievable because they are part of the kind of the mystique of childhood. You know, they might have not even existed.
They're as reliable as any other childhood memory.
Yes, exactly. They are. I think that's so true.
Jotam, thank you. It's been a privilege and a pleasure to meet.
It's good to end on this note. Thank you so much.
Jotam Ottolenghi, in his new book, is Simple. You'll find it with all the others in bookshops. You will not, however, find, if you are still curious about the title, the ontological status of the photographic image in aesthetic and analytic philosophy, because that was Jotam's master's thesis back in 1997, just to show that he has Catholic tastes.